I think a lot of students and faculty, we get caught up in this notion that in order to be scholarly, in order to be rigorous, one must be very strict and strident in the classroom.
Hi, I'm Catherine Rollwagen, professor of history at Vancouver Island University. Welcome to Conversations in the Arts and Humanities. We introduce you to the people and passions of the Faculty of Arts and Humanities at VIU and share stories about the projects and events happening on campus. Since 2009, the Faculty of Arts and Humanities has been presenting the Colloquium, a series of lectures that brings our faculty's practices and research to the public. This fall, the Colloquium series will open with a presentation by Dr. Amelia Horsberg, entitled A Commitment to HUGA, Building and Embracing Student Engagement in the Classroom. Today, Dr. Theo Finnegan sits down with Amelia to talk about their teaching practice and the classroom environment. Both are members of the English department at VIU.
Hi, Amelia. Nice to see you.
It's good to see you too, Theo.
It's really nice to have you here today. Like me, you're a professor of English at VIU, and it means you did an English degree at some point, or several English degrees. I wondered if you could tell me a little bit about what drew you to the discipline. Was it something you always wanted to do? Was it a circuitous route? How did you become an English professor?
I think that's a really interesting question. Yeah. Because we all come to this discipline through different avenues, for sure. Mm. First and foremost, I grew up in Windsor, Ontario. And in my community, everybody had a parent or an aunt or an uncle or a grandparent who worked in the automotive industry. Everybody worked for the big three. So growing up, most of my friends, they had plans to either work on the line or become a teacher, or really sort of strategic career pathways that were just made sense to us and were mentored by our parents, right?
Right.
In my family, my mom was an academic. She had her PhD in nursing and was head of the Department of Nursing at the University of Windsor. So that was my model. And my dad, of course, worked at Ford Motor. So I sort of saw those two career paths as, well, those are the best options, obviously, because my folks, that's what they do. But I knew nursing maybe wasn't a perfect fit for me. I thought I could be a nurse, but there was something that was just not quite a perfect fit. But on the other hand, I knew that I loved literature, whether it be French literature or English literature. And so I started my undergrad at the University of Windsor, and I had double honors in French and English. And that year, of course, my mom took a job on the prairie. So our whole family, when I was 19, 20 years old, we moved to Saskatchewan, which was a huge move for us. So I continued my undergrad work at the University of Saskatchewan in, again, French and English literature. I did an exchange over to France for a whole year and did French literature at the Université de Strasbourg. Really enjoyed, again, working in literature. And then when it came time to do my master's, I wasn't too sure where to go. I didn't have a sense of, you know, I really want to go to X school. So I did what a lot of folks do, I think. They met a very special person who mattered a lot to them. Of course, I'm talking about my husband, Justin. And he was working in Cleveland, Ohio. So I thought, well, I'll apply to Case Western Reserve University. I'll see if they're interested. And they were. I was super lucky. They gave me a great scholarship. They were willing to pay for me to go to school there. Awesome. It was meant to be. So went and I did 2 years at Case Western's, where I did my master's in world literature, actually. And after the master's was complete, again, I wasn't too sure where should the PhD happen. By then, my mom had gone to the University of Alberta, come back to the University of Saskatchewan. So I thought, well, perfect fit. Let's go and study at the University of Saskatchewan. And that's where I did my PhD.
You mentioned that you always loved literature. Mm-hmm. So one question, I'm also in the field of literature. I work at VIU as well in English. And I struggle with reading for pleasure. So I love reading. I've always loved reading, but now it's a job.
Yeah.
And so I don't always get much time to read for fun. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you do, and if so, what's something you've read recently that you could recommend for people to read that would be cool or fun?
Absolutely. I think a lot of people, not just academics, struggle with finding time to read for pleasure. I was talking to my students about it just yesterday in class in the afternoon, and I said to them, you know, I know most of you have done your reading to prepare for today's class, but are you reading for pleasure before you go to bed at night? Are you carving out that 10, 15, 20 minutes, whatever it is, to read for pleasure? And what do you read for pleasure? And they all looked at me like, I read my textbooks. And I'm like, no. What do you read that brings you joy, that brings you some satisfaction and fun to your life? And they all sort of pause. I was like, maybe it's the Snapchat. Maybe it's Twitter. I don't know. Maybe it's a golf magazine. Whatever you find relaxing and brings you joy, then that's what you should be reading at night. It doesn't need to be literature with a capital L.
As Kramer and Seinfeld says at one point, we can't all be reading the classics, Professor Highbrow.
Everybody in the world should be reading for pleasure, right? But for university students, it's such a challenge to get them doing their homeworks and doing their readings to prepare for class. But then carving out that time, because we know, we've done the research, we know that good readers make good writers.
So tell me about a book you've read recently that you can recommend or that you thought was great.
I have, like all academics, I have like 4 or 5 books on my nightstand that I'm currently reading. And, you know, you've gotten a couple chapters into each and every one. I think the last one that I actually finished with Sherry Demelin's The Marrow Thieves. I don't read that genre a lot, meaning young adult fiction, and that's sort of who it's the publisher has sort of said that this is who this text is for, is young adults. So it wasn't really on my radar, but then, you know, I think it's turned into a real, almost a modern classic, if it were, for dystopian sort of literature that is for and about Indigenous youth, right? And that's something that I think as Canadians, it's important to read that. Yeah. It's important to read about that experience, even though it's a fictionalized experience. Nevertheless, it's absolutely worth reading about those experiences.
I haven't read that book, but I've heard about it, and it's sort of science fiction-y.
Yes.
But also engages with Indigenous history and residential school history and things
yeah.
like that.
It's just a new form of colonialism is taking place. So they're rounding up Indigenous people and they're taking their dreams from them, because it's turned into a predicament that everybody in the world is no longer able to dream. So that's sort of what the premise is.
It's a very powerful metaphor.
Hi, my name is Catherine, and I teach in the History Department at Vancouver Island University. You're listening to Conversations in the Arts and Humanities on CHLY 101.7 FM, Nanaimo.
So without wanting to give too much away, you're giving a talk in VIU's Malaspina Theatre on September 27th about the concept of, and I'm going to totally get this pronunciation wrong, hygge.
That's correct, yeah.
Which is a Danish word,
yep.
I believe, how it relates to teaching practice. And I wonder if you could give us a quick preview of what maybe folks could expect if they come to see you give that presentation.
How I came to this term, how it found me, was actually back in Saskatchewan. We were finding the winters, my whole family, everybody was finding it very long and dark, right? And cold. So my mom heard, similar to what we're doing right now, somebody come on the radio and talk about this idea of hygge and how we need to bring more elements of hygge into our lifestyle here in Canada. So what hygge is the best translation. It's a Danish term, as we said, but the closest translation we could get into English is coziness, all right? So feelings of coziness and what engenders, what brings about those feelings. So in the wintertime in Saskatchewan, for us, it was sitting around in the family room, turning on the fireplace, getting some nice warm blankies, maybe having some tea, maybe something different than tea. Maybe it's a glass of wine or a beer. An adult beverage, a pop, as we say, sitting around and enjoying one another's conversation, right? Turning off the phones, turning off the television, and just being together and talking about one another's day and doing that in such a way that you feel comfort, you feel protected, safe, and joy, right?
It's a lovely idea, and yeah. You described it beautifully, I think.
Thank you. Well, I try to practice it in my own life, not just in my teaching practice, but really here in Nanaimo, we practice hygge maybe a little bit differently. But it's had a huge impact. I think anybody who's ever experienced issues with depression or anxiety, I think incorporating hygge into your everyday life is a wonderful way to mitigate some of those feelings of depression or anxious feelings that sort of build up sometimes in us. Yeah, so it's really worked well for me in my personal life as well.
Does it have, I don't know if you know this, but does it have anything to do with hug? Is there, I feel like there might be a kind of long etymological history where it goes back to the same root as hugging someone or a sort of...
Snuggliness?
Yeah, snuggliness. I don't know.
That's a really good question, Theo. Yeah. I would have to look a little bit deeper into the meaning of the word.
Teaching and hygge.
Mm-hmm.
I don't immediately think of comfort and, you know, like the you think of a classroom, it's hardback chairs and everyone's kind of sitting there and stuck in position and focusing on the board and trying to learn really hard and it's difficult and challenging. How does hygge come into the classroom?
Well, that's the rub, right? I think a lot of students and faculty, we get caught up in this notion that in order to be scholarly, in order to be rigorous, one must be very strict and strident in the classroom. I don't think those things need to go hand in hand in the post-secondary classroom. In fact, I don't think they should go hand in hand. I think in the 21st century, I really believe deeply that our classroom spaces need to be spaces where students feel safe, spaces where students come in and they're happy to be there. Do you know what I mean?
I want
them to wake up in the morning and say, I have class with Professor Horsberg this morning, and if all else, I know I'm going to have a good hour and 20 minutes today. Yeah. And for some of our students, I think it's really important. Yeah. I think they have a lot going on in their lives right now. A lot of them work part-time or full-time and try to go to school here. A lot of them childcare, elder care needs. There's lots going on in their lives, right? Lots of stresses. So if they can come to school and know that they're going to get a quality experience for an hour and 20, all about how to improve their writing practice, let's say, but in such a fashion that they feel care, they feel comfort, they feel supported, that's golden. That's what I'm trying to achieve.
I think it makes total sense. And I think that you're going to learn better if you feel comfortable and happy in the classroom. It seems to me to be a really good point.
I've always experienced it that as a student myself, did I learn the best in an environment where I felt like the teacher was supporting me, knew my name, right? In post-secondary, that can be very rare. I think at VIU, because our class sizes are small, right? We max at 30 in our English classes. We can learn names and call and refer to our students by name. They can learn one another's name. So that's just one teaching practice that I do. I make sure that students create name tents on the very first day. They look at me like I'm bananas. Really? We're not in grade school, Professor Horsberg. Why are we creating name tents? So I have to talk them through. Listen, there's method to my madness. We're going to create name tents. So I learn your name. So when I see you walking around campus, I can say, hey, Levi, how's it going, bud? Are you having a good day? Or why didn't I see you in class this morning? Were you here? Did you, you know, miss your alarm? Like what was happening? Knowing students' names is paramount. And it's a way too, in a first year class, for them to make friends, right? If they're here and they've just moved to Nanaimo, it can be a super isolating experience, really. And this is just another way that they can engage with one another. One of my favorite parts about teaching here is that it's such a small community that you can go to Superstore, you can go on a hike or a trail or go to Starbucks, and I am guaranteed to hear running from, or not running, I don't think they run up to me, but they do, I do hear from across the grocery store, "Hey, Professor Horsberg!" And I'll be like, "Oh my goodness, there's another student." And I can introduce them to my family if we're shopping together, or if I'm at Starbucks, they'll make me a lovely beverage. It's fantastic to run into your students.
It is.
Yeah, I love it.
When I had my first child earlier this year, and I'd be shopping for baby stuff at like Babies R Us or Walmart. And for some reason at that time, I kept in a bunch of students that I'd had were working, as you're saying, they work often, working part-time jobs or something at those places. And I'd see them in the checkout. And so we'd have this conversation about how, you know, how's the pregnancy going? How's the baby once they were born? It was really, really meaningful, really, really cool.
It humanizes not only professors, but our students. We only see them for such a short period of time that we sometimes forget that our course is not their only thing going on in their lives, right? So when we run into our students and they see that we have families, we have lives outside of the classroom,
yes.
I think that models good balance between, yes, we're scholars, yes, we get our work done here at VIU, but we also have our downtime, our family time, right?
And I think that's really important for us as instructors to also be enjoying teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And so often it can become, you know, you're in the middle of term, you're teaching four or five classes, you're working every day, you're trying to do other things in life, and it can sometimes seem like it's an uphill battle. You're exhausted. It's really challenging. The marking's piling up, and so having that sort of mentality or pedagogy, I suppose, where it becomes something that you can get some kind of pleasure out of and a meaningful experience in the classroom, I think could be not just valuable for students, in other words, valuable for you and for me and for us.
Absolutely. I mean, when you think about it, there's so much open source information that's available on the internet now. So if students want to learn about strong writing skills, they could, in theory, right, do some research online, do some work on their own, don't necessarily have to do post-secondary, right? So what makes it different about coming to a classroom and doing post-secondary work, right?
Yes.
I want my students to know that there is value gained in coming to a classroom and having an expert like myself talk them, walk them through the experience of strong writing, right? How do we get there? How are we going to accomplish those goals together as a group?
I'm always reading about how the age of the human instructor is coming to an end, and it's going to be robots, or we can deliver much more efficiently teaching in technological ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you've just made a really great argument for, not to say that technology is bad, because of course not, but that the human interaction in the classroom is part of the experience and part of the learning, actually.
Yeah, it's the human connection that you create that primes you to experience what's going to happen in the classroom, right? For example, if I come into the classroom in the morning, I always start with, "Good morning, everybody," or "Good morning, my Mariners." I call my students my Mariners.
I love that.
Yeah, they're my Mariners. And then Halloween, I dress up as a Mariner. I come to school all dressed up. Yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I go hardcore. Yeah.
What does a Mariner look like for you?
My Mariner, I wear a yellow slicker, and I borrow one of my husband's crab traps. And I make him clean it before, because otherwise they're kind of stinky, right? So I carry a crab trap, and I put my textbooks and stuff into the crab trap. I'm telling you, I'm serious. I wear big, like, rubber boots, big galoshes.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'll carry a fishing pole. At least this is what I did last year.
I need to step up my game in the classroom. I need to do something like this. That sounds amazing. What's students' reactions?
They laugh usually at me, but I'm okay with that. I want them to get a giggle in the morning. Yeah. And I'm having fun. So I know they think that, you know, there's the, the idea that, you know, of a bad dad joke. I am like the epitome of bad dad jokes some days. Yeah.
Super useful teaching technique I've found over the years is to be able to sort of laugh at yourself.
Oh, absolutely.
And break down a little bit of that intimidation factor or the mystification of scholarship, right? We make bad jokes as well. We're funny.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I even have a stuffed sturgeon. Now, not like taxidermy. don't imagine that I carry around a taxidermy sturgeon. I carry around a stuffed pretend sturgeon that I bought at the campus store. And he comes with me to class periodically. He pops in, Stew the sturgeon. He carries with him good juju, so which means good vibes, right? So again, adding to that hygge-esque atmosphere. So I bring Stewie especially to exams. And Stewie sits at the front of the room with me. And if it looks like somebody's maybe struggling a little bit and it's all coming together, they're like, whoa, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do this for the next 3 hours. Stewie may find his way to their table and he sits with them. And you wouldn't believe how calming sometimes this little guy can be for them.
So this is, I believe, the 10th anniversary of the Arts and Humanities Colloquium series.
Yeah.
We've been doing this for 10 years. I wondered if you could say a little bit about what's good about giving a presentation that's based in your pedagogy and scholarship, but is also for people maybe outside of the university community as well. What's important about that for you?
It's an accessible event. I always remind myself that not everybody has been lucky enough to experience post-secondary education. It's expensive. Right? And not everybody has the time or the cash to do that. So an event like this enables everybody to attend and to experience and demystify, I think, what we do as scholars and what kind of impact I'm making. I like to think that I'm making an impact on the students in my classroom. And I want people to come, enjoy the colloquium, and get to see what that experience is like. So if maybe, you know, after you finished high school, you went out to work, and now you're thinking about, maybe I want to try something a little different. Maybe I want to go back to school. I think attending something like a colloquium is a great way to see what we're all about. It really does demystify what we do here. So yes, I teach lots of university writing and research methods, but I also have my own research, right? And my research is all about the pedagogy and practice of teaching, right? And it really brings it home because I'm going to talk about actual. So for faculty who teach here at VIU, they can come and learn about some of the strategies that I implement in the classroom space. Because as you know, Theo, most of us never get the chance to see one another teach, ever. And educators, we're so thoughtful in the sense that we're very thoughtful in sharing of materials and ideas, right? So if you're ever on, like I am, I like to be on Twitter, and I'll go on, and I like to follow other educators who have these wonderful ideas about classroom practice and ways to engage your students, right? And I follow folks who are educators from the primary, high school, and university setting, right? Or college setting. And you'd be surprised how somebody who, say, teaches kindergarten or somebody teaches grade 9 math might have a strategy that I can just tweak and I can make it work at the post-secondary level. Yeah. And we're comfortable sharing those strategies with one another. That's fantastic. I love it.
I'm really looking forward to your talk on September 27th about hygge in the classroom. Thanks so much for coming in to talk to me today. It was really great.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Theo.
You've been listening to Conversations in the Arts and Humanities. Thanks to Theo Finnegan and Amelia Horsberg for their conversation. Technical production by Robin Davies. We've got more talks on tap throughout the fall. In October, Professor Eliza Gardner will talk about the relevance of the Greek play Oedipus Rex to contemporary Canadian perspectives on criminal behavior. In November, percussionist and music instructor Hans Verhoeven will perform with his students Adam Robertson and James Bowman. We hope to see you there. I'm Catherine Rollwagen. Thanks for listening.